Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to your leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Associate Editorial Director with Neurology Live. In this episode, we spoke with Eli Pollard, the Vice President and Chief Education and Training Officer at the Parkinson's Foundation, as well as the Executive Director of the World Parkinson Coalition. She spoke with us about the Foundation's ongoing efforts in providing education about Parkinson's disease to community providers, the challenges of managing a growing population of patients, and the need for community physicians and specialists to work in unison, among many other topics. So without further ado, let's dive in.
Hi, my name is Eli Pollard. I'm the VP and Chief Education and Training Officer at the Parkinson's Foundation. In a nutshell, we know that there are over a million people living with Parkinson's in the United States. We also know from data that only 9% of those people are actually seeing a movement disorder specialist, and around 50% are seeing neurologists, and around 41% are seeing I'm throwing my numbers off a little bit. Around 29% are seeing family physicians. And then there's this mysterious sort of 10% or 11% that are sort of seeing, we don't even know who they're seeing, right? And so data has shown over and over that to get the best care around Parkinson's, you do want to see someone who understands movement disorders, understands Parkinson's. And yet there is a shortcoming. There are only 600 to 700 movement disorder specialists across the United States. That is not enough to treat the 1 million people. And they tend to also be clustered in specific places around the country. So there are these empty sort of spaces where it's even hard to find someone, even if you want to find a movement disorder specialist. And so, you know, the Parkinson's Foundation has prioritized educating healthcare professionals who may not be movement disorder specialists, but who do treat and see people with Parkinson's. We know that there are a lot of healthcare professionals working at the community level. And that was really the idea behind this program and designing this program and launching this, is to create a course that helps licensed, trained health professionals who just don't know a lot about Parkinson's, so that they can understand and be more comfortable when that person does walk in their clinic a few times out of the year, perhaps, or once a month. So that's the gist behind the course. And we broke it into six different sort of target audiences, with the first part of the six-part series really focused on neurologists and advanced practitioners. And again, it's a course that should be digestible for anyone who is a trained healthcare professional. You don't need to have any background in movement disorders or Parkinson's research in any way to understand this. It really is the basic sort of PD 101 for healthcare professionals. How do you take care of your patient with Parkinson's and ensure that they're getting the best treatment options when they see you?
Absolutely. And even for the specialists, just thinking about us, the meetings we've gone to this year, just the amount that they have to keep up with is jarring as well. So I can't imagine how challenging it might be for, a small town neurologist who's just, hey, I have like three patients with Parkinson's disease. I don't really know what to be doing. So you mentioned, obviously, there's, a cluster of these audiences you're targeting. So for the members of the clinical community who might consume this or see these, this interview, listen to this interview in some way, who are those ideal learners? What specific groups, again, like the community neurologists and the APCs, are really kind of the ideal people who should be consuming this? And why was it such a priority to create this in a multidisciplinary audience?
Oh, I love that question. So twofold. So I'll just say part sort of series, right, that we're mapping out. It's sort of six different sessions, six different educational programs, and they're going to vary the target audience, but So for example, the first one, we are targeting physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. So that's sort of the core target audience. But I'll be quite honest, I went through the course more than once, and it's really great for anyone. So if you're not a physician or a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant, you're still going to get something out of it if you work with or and or treat people with Parkinson's. But that was sort of the target audience, just trying to frame it for us. So that's the first course. And the other courses, they vary. So we have one course that's targeted at people who, work in a hospital setting. And while there are a lot of people working in hospital settings, we are targeting, you know, people that work in hospital settings, pharmacists, neurologists, nurses who are working and physicians working in a hospital setting. We have one course that is really going to just be focused on social workers. And while the target audience for that course is entirely social workers, again, I think lots of people will get something out of it, even if it's not specifically for your discipline. One course I'm excited to offer, and it's a very narrow specific group, is going to be about dental care. And we are going to be presenting this course with in mind, we're trying to reach dentists. That's who we want to educate, dentists who I think have very little opportunity to learn really about Parkinson's and the complexities of Parkinson's and how it becomes even hard for a person with Parkinson's to get their teeth cleaned, because at some point it's hard for them to even lay back and have, you know, lay back in a chair with problems with swallowing and breath and whatnot. So that course is going to be targeted at dentists, but we're bringing in speech language pathologists, occupational therapists, somebody with Parkinson's, and dentists to help put that program together. So we every course is a little bit different. I think there's value in every single part of the 6-part series. But you asked the question about, you know, interprofessional care. Why are we focused on that? So for a couple of reasons, because Parkinson's is such a complex disease, it does impact multiple systems in the body. You do really need to have a team approach when you tackle Parkinson's. This is something that the Parkinson's Foundation has believed in and supported for more than 2 decades now. We really do believe that interprofessional care can impact the kind of care that a person with Parkinson's gets. We also recognize it's just not possible everywhere to do interprofessional care to the extent that we think you need. But that could mean that you're in a location where you have even just 2 or 3 different disciplines that work together. That could be potentially your team. You could be one of those fortunate people who work in a clinic or a space that has 11 different disciplines. Obviously, that would be ideal and a dream, not always a reality, which we recognize. But when we design our material, we do design it through the lens of interprofessional care. We are an accredited organization with the joint accreditation in order to offer interprofessional continuing education. And so we do strive to offer as many interprofessional courses as possible. And that means bringing the interprofessional team together to design the course, having interprofessionals present in the course, and even have interprofessionals review and mitigate and review all the content to validate it before it goes live. So it's kind of a complex process, but we believe in it, and we're really thrilled to be able to offer interprofessional continuing education, since it's at the core of sort of what we do with our professional education programs.
You know, and I wonder too, you know, you mentioned obviously a number of these courses are geared at, you know, say social workers specifically, or those in a hospital setting, but we do talk, you know, and I'm just thinking back again to sort of conversations with movement sort of specialists that we've been having this year. And whenever we talk about interdisciplinary care, multidisciplinary care, a lot of the conversation does boil around, well, what do you do if you don't have that team at your disposal? And to your point, you know, a lot of these specialists do tend to be grouped at these, you know, these major institutions along the East Coast, or, you know, near Chicago or wherever they may be. Do you think that there's some benefit that might be able to be derived, that maybe you can fill in those gaps? Obviously not going to be everything you need, but, you know, a physician who doesn't have a social worker at their disposal taking the social worker course, you can learn a little bit of those skills. Do you think an added benefit of providing sort of these targeted audiences here for maybe the people who don't have access to those care members?
I absolutely believe that. I mean, if you really can't add a social worker to your team because of financial limitations or barriers, just even finding someone qualified and interested locally to fill that role, I do think that watching these courses as they unfold or as we roll them out, I do think that gives you a sense of what that person can bring to the table. I've been fascinated myself. We have an incredible team training program at the foundation that's been running since 2004. And the whole point of that program, it's just an in-person training and virtual training, is to help team members actually understand what other team members do. And so to your point, a lot of times you don't realize what a social worker can do on a team. I've stood in front of a room of healthcare professionals, diverse healthcare professionals, and I've said, okay, all of our occupational therapists, keep your hands down. Everyone else, tell me, do you know what role the occupational therapist plays on a team? What can they actually do to help your patient when they have, say, cognitive decline? What role can an OT play? No one raises their hand because they don't know what an occupational therapist does. And these are even people with team members. They don't fully understand what their own team members can do. So if you don't have the team member, you're even more removed. So I do think that this is a wonderful opportunity. If someone's at that point where they're thinking, yeah, I've heard a social worker would be nice to have on the team, I don't really understand what value they're going to bring. Maybe you watch this course and you think, oh, those are all the things a good social worker working in the movement source space could do. Now I understand the value. I'm going to bring them into my team. So I think it's a couple of things. One, you understand what they do, and you could then perhaps try to fill in some of those gaps that you don't have. You might also realize and understand the value of having a social worker on your team. And then you might say, okay, this is worth it. I'm going to bring them in. So it's a constant conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we started this off talking a little bit about, alluding to, I guess, really more than talking about these challenges with, you know, educating the members of the clinical care team and the sort of downstream effect of those things. You know, obviously, when major changes happen in the field, the specialists tend to find out first, and then it sort of trickles its way down, which I imagine causes a lot of difficulty because there's obviously a lot of people to educate, and there's a bit of lag time in how quickly I imagine we'd like to see some of that education disseminated. But, you know, from the foundation's perspective, again, as a group that's, you know, producing these types of educational materials, what are those kind of key challenges as far as it pertains to disseminating education materials for the field in recent years? You know, what have kind of been the difficulties that you've seen the foundation kind of face in getting those materials out? I imagine obviously the virtual aspect of a lot of these things makes access a little easier, but, you know, what is there a challenge in actually like getting this material in front of people? Is it an awareness thing? Do these community neurologists not realize that these materials exist? You know, I'm just curious because it's always interesting to hear, you know, from the clinician perspective, hey, this is how we're having a hard, you know, this is what's preventing us from going out into the community neurologist. But obviously the foundation, you have a little more, for lack of a phrasing, I guess, time to focus on that as a priority. So what are kind of the roadblocks that you guys have experienced?
Well, I mean, there are, I think, a number of challenges. You mentioned one earlier is that, you know, physicians and neurologists have to know an awful lot. And there are a lot of niche areas. It's a lot. I mean, to just process everything. And if you're not seeing a lot of people with Parkinson's, you're not going to prioritize that as a space that you need to learn. And so if you have one person with Parkinson's pop in, you know, every other month, are you really going to go to a conference on Parkinson's? Are you really going to invest hours and hours learning? You might. But you might have, you know, 20 patients with migraine headaches. That might be more of a priority for you. I'm just using that off the top of my head. So I think that's part of the challenge. I mean, I think our healthcare providers are incredibly, I don't want to say overworked, but I do think they are overworked. And our system, you know, our healthcare system has flaws, as we know. Most physicians and neurologists and movement disorder specialists, they only get, you know, 15 minutes even with a patient. And so there's a limited amount of time. There's just a lot of depressed. So for us, I think the biggest barrier is that if someone is not seeing a lot of people with Parkinson's or movement disorders, they may not prioritize that as a space to do extracurricular learning. And I understand that. I think the challenge for us is that we see the numbers of people with Parkinson's increasing quite quickly, actually around the globe, with the longer, people living longer. That's really the number one reason we're seeing an increase in Parkinson's, is that people are living longer, and age is the number one risk factor for diagnosis with Parkinson's. I also suspect there are better diagnostic tools. So not only are people living longer and getting diagnosed, there may be people even being diagnosed a little earlier because our tools and our understanding are better. So the numbers are increasing. And so even though physicians may not be prioritizing Parkinson's as a space they need to be learning, the numbers are increasing, and they do need to prioritize. So the onus is on us to impress upon them the importance of understanding Parkinson's, because if they're not seeing patients now, they are or will most likely be seeing more people in the future. That's a barrier for sure. I think we have the good fortune of being able to offer a number of educational programs, both online and live and hybrid. And so I do think that being able to offer the online, we have a learning management system called Learning Lab, which we've just recently revamped and launched in the last month or so. And that learning management system has a number of courses, most of them free, and they offer continuing education. That is going to be an opportunity for us to reach more people than we have in the past by offering these through this online learning portal. You know, we have these wonderful training programs, but one of the barriers for these in-person training programs or anything that's live, that's done together online, is that people just can't get the time off to go and do these trainings. Our team training program is a 3.5-day intensive in-person training. That's hard to get that time off. So we're really excited about the learning management system. Offering the Parkinson's Foundation Learning Lab is a way to fill in that gap when people want to learn but can't make it to an actual in-person training. They can still learn online. And again, because since we're joint accredited, they can get credit for it as well. So free credit, amazing courses. I think the biggest barrier for most of us is just lack of time or ability to take time off.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Eli to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, Theranica's Nerivio, a remote electrical neuromodulation device, has received FDA approval as a dual-use acute and preventive treatment for migraine with or without aura in patients 12 years of age and older, adding to its list of indications. This FDA indication is supported by results from a randomized placebo-controlled study that was published in Headache, which demonstrated significant reduction in monthly migraine days and other prevention endpoints. Next, the FDA has approved omaveloxolone, branded as Skyclarys, an agent developed by Reata Pharmaceuticals, for the treatment of Friedreich ataxia in adults and adolescents aged 16 years and older, making it the first and only therapy approved for this indication. The treatment, an oral once-daily medication, is indicated with a recommended dose of 150 milligrams taken in 3 capsules. Next, the FDA has accepted Eisai's supplemental biologic license application for the traditional approval of lecanemab, also known as Leqembi, an anti-amyloid therapy approved for patients with early Alzheimer's disease. The agency has placed a prescription drug user fee action date of July 6th for the decision. And finally, according to news from Abbott, the FDA has cleared its Alinity I Laboratory Traumatic Brain Injury Blood Test, the first commercially available test of its kind. The test will be available in hospitals to quickly assist clinicians in assessing patients with concussions in an objective way that can help to develop next steps of care for patients. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Eli Pollard.
If you're a specialist, especially trying to pick and choose, okay, what meetings do I choose to go to this year? What don't I go to? What, you know, educational events do I have the ability to take the time off for? And I obviously think sort of this rising incidence of neurologic disease across the board is a challenge, particularly with the lack of physicians to meet that number of people and treat that number of people. But I'm glad that you brought up sort of access, because again, I think this particularly with, like, again, societal meetings and stuff, this sort of virtual hybrid model that we've seen kind of emerge out of the COVID-19 pandemic, I think has really helped improve access. But I do think that a lot of these larger societies are slowly starting to sort of shift away from that model because it is expensive, particularly when we talk about, like, meetings and conferences. But, you know, from your perspective, how do programs like this really help increase that access? Because, again, you know, we're talking about Parkinson's is, not even a rare disease. And how much time in medical school gets focused on, on movement disorders and what's going on in that space? Probably very little. And then now we're talking about a whole, field of neurologists that need to be up to date on it. So, what's kind of the focus from the Parkinson's Foundation in terms of the steps you guys are taking to kind of help improve that access outside of, just this specific program? Like, what's the is there, if there is one, sort of a long-term plan to kind of continue to help make that type of education available for people and open for everybody?
Yeah. I mean, we're doing so many great things. I could talk for days, to be honest, but I'll highlight just a few things. We have over the years really focused on sort of a multi-pronged effect in a multi-pronged sort of strategy in educating health professionals. We know that there are an awful lot of health professionals working in the field that get their licensure and they have no training on Parkinson's when they go out into the greater wild world and start, treating people. Do a multi-pronged sort of approach. So we believe that, there are a lot of people go out into the working field with little to no training on Parkinson's. And yet, like I said earlier, the numbers are just increasing. So there's more of a need in that training. So there are all these people working. So this is where we offer these online programs, these in-person programs to try and offer as many varieties to access the information as possible. So there are virtual programs online you can get credit for. There are programs online that you don't have to get credit for. Maybe you don't care about credit. You're from a place in the world that you don't need credit in the US or your state doesn't require it. You can just access it. And most of our programs, again, are free. And then we have these in-person training. We're trying to also just change, sort of move the needle on training. We have two programs. They're actually focused on nurses and physical therapists right now. These are long-term programs that actually train the faculty who are teaching the students in academic settings. So many years ago, there were some leading nurses in the US from UPenn who did a survey, and they questioned the top 20 nursing schools across the country. And they said, how in a four-year baccalaureate nursing program, how much are you teaching about Parkinson's? And the data came back that it was less than 1 hour on average over 4 years. And they had, I think, a little bit of a panic moment because they thought, since they'd gone through nursing school, that it would have gotten better since they'd gone through years before. And so they went back out to the faculty and followed up and said, why aren't you teaching more? And the faculty universally said, we're not teaching more because we don't know enough about Parkinson's to teach about it. We're told we have to teach about neurological issues. So we choose epilepsy, stroke, migraine, and other things that we're comfortable with. We don't know how to teach about Parkinson's. No one taught us. So we have a program at the foundation that trains nurse faculty. And there have been more than 300 nurse faculty trained on how to teach about Parkinson's. And now those 300 nurse faculty teach 27,000 nursing students a year. On Parkinson's, they've revamped their educational curriculum at their schools. And so it went from 1 hour. Some schools now teach 4 hours, some teach eight. It doesn't seem like a lot, but if you go from 1 hour to eight, that's significantly different in a curriculum, which is incredible. We also have a program similar to this for physical therapy professors so that they can teach about Parkinson's in their environment and to their students as well. So we're trying to capture people before they even get out of school so they at least enter the space with a little more of a comfort zone and more comfortable in the Parkinson's world, and hopefully to even inspire some of them. If they're in school and they learn about it, they might say, that's really fascinating. I think I'm going to try and learn a little more about that. So we've got those things going on. We've got our training for teams going on. And now we've got this dynamic sort of growing learning management system with all sorts of learning opportunities for people. So we recognize that, model is not going to work for everyone. So it's why we're trying to offer multiple opportunities for learning. We do think that access to information is really important, and how, we're still trying to figure out what that magic, what the magic is to inspire a healthcare professional to come to our system and actually learn. I think part of it is just creating really good quality content that, you know, they can apply immediately and they can learn from it and turn around and apply it right in their clinic to the patients that they're seeing. So it's an ongoing struggle for us. We're definitely, you know, inspired by the people we work with and trying to figure out how to get them the material that they need. We just know so many people are not getting good care. And it's just not even that they're not necessarily getting good care. It's that some people are getting bad care. And that is really terrifying to us because, you know, when you have Parkinson's and you live with this disease for sometimes decades, you know, that care in the beginning could really change the trajectory of just how you feel about the disease you live with and how you sort of move forward in the world. And so we're constantly trying to figure out ways to bring people in and inspire them to learn more and make it a priority.
Yeah, I mean, to that point too, especially if you can see sort of the impact of good care, you know, just how well patients can do when they get that good care, seeing bad, it's like, this is available. We have to, you know what I mean? So yeah, I'm right there with you. And it's very interesting. I'm glad to hear that there's educational efforts in sort of the medical school level, because I know that's, whenever we talk about this sort of shortage of physicians, particularly the shortage of neurologists, you know, the number one issue we hear, you know, from sleep medicine specialists, from movement disorder specialists, from pretty much everyone except the kind of three you named, the migraine, which, you know, 40 million Americans with migraine, I hope we're talking about it a little bit in medical school, you know, stroke, the big quote unquote ones. I do always, that's the number one thing we hear is, you know, hey, how do we get more people interested in neurology? We expose them to it earlier. You know what I mean? Why are we not talking about these things in medical school? So that's awesome. Is there anything else either about this specific educational series or just sort of the efforts that the PD Foundation is working on sort of headed into 2023 that you think is important to mention, just kind of closing thought?
Yeah, two things that I think are super exciting is on the point of the shortage or not enough movement disorder physicians, we are actually piloting a program right now for nurse practitioner movement disorder fellows. And we have some fellows that are going through a nurse practitioner fellowship at two of our centers of excellence. And the plan is that we're collecting the data we need to get it actually accredited by the American Nursing Credentialing Center so that we can start to get nurse practitioners trained in movement disorders as well, especially to fill in the gaps where their physicians are not there or to just, you know, expand our population. So there's that, super exciting. And, you know, we're in the middle of that now and the data is incredible and the nurse practitioner fellows are absolutely over the moon and they're learning very quickly. It's really exciting to see it. And the other thing, you know, we're launching a program in January, a program that we've adopted from some amazing healthcare professionals in the space. It's called Community Partners in Parkinson Care. And it's basically a really dynamic, robust training program for, make sure I get this right, I was scolded earlier for the wrong phrase, for care communities and home care agencies. So these are you know, communities and agencies like long-term care, senior living, nursing home, home care agency. We know that there are an awful lot of people with Parkinson's living in these communities and working with these agencies. And we know that it's crucial that they get good care. And unfortunately, they're not in many situations getting good care. So we have this program that we've adopted and we'll be launching it under the PF umbrella in January. Super excited to basically train at people in these communities so that they can deliver better care. And then these care communities and home care agencies can actually put a stamp of approval sort of on their materials to say that they've gone through the Parkinson's Foundation training for this. So we've got great things going on. We're trying to hit all the healthcare professionals across the spectrum. It's a lot to chew on, but we're really excited for what's to come in 2023.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, you can visit neurologylive.com.